Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to actress Tippi Hedren, star of two classic Alfred Hitchcock films, The Birds and Marnie. Her experiences with the legendary British director are detailed in a new HBO film, The Girl, in which she is portrayed by Sienna Miller. Stick around, but please check that park bench before sitting on it. Those damn pigeons have been acting funny all day. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, brought to you today by the Stitcher app for mobile devices. Give it a test drive today at stitcher.com/mrmedia, Mr. Media. I love this free radio app, and I think you will too. stitcher.com/mrmedia. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of creepy old men with British accents, cigars, and pot bellies who keep promising to put me in moving pictures in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. We know Tippi Hedren for many reasons. As a young model, she was plucked from a successful career in one field by British film director Alfred Hitchcock to star in two of his most fondly remembered works, The Birds and Marnie. A falling out with Hitchcock over sexual harassment accusations slowed her career opportunities when she refused his advances, but the beautiful young woman found ways of staying in the public consciousness. And she never stopped working in a variety of roles, large and small, over the years. She is also the mother of another prominent American actress, Melanie Griffith, Academy Award-nominated star of Working Girl. And her philanthropic commitment to abandon exotic felines, lions, tigers, cougars, black and spotted leopards, servals, bobcats, and Asian leopard cats showed the public another side of her when she founded the Ruhr Foundation and Shambhala Preserve on the outskirts of Los Angeles in 1983. The preserve is home to 50 retired big cats, and she'll appear before Congress on September 20th to speak on behalf of the Big Cats and Public Safety Protection Act. And Ms. Hedren is back in the headlines and on the small screen with the upcoming release on HBO of The Girl, a made-for-TV movie about her strained relationship with Hitchcock. Sienna Miller plays Hedren, and Toby Jones plays the director in the film, which debuts in October. The story is about a young actress fighting off the hands and sexual demands of a cinematic legend unaccustomed to taking no for an answer. And it has taken Ms. Hedren 50 years to get even with Hitchcock, but her moment is approaching. And in addition to being portrayed in The Girl, Ms. Hedren is also shooting an upcoming episode of the Fox sitcom Raising Hope, in which she is typecast as Melanie Griffith's mother. Where does Hollywood get these crazy ideas? Tippi Hedren, welcome to Mr. Media.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Media. If I may just correct one thing.
Please.
We are rescuing animals. These are not retired big cats. These are animals, lions, tigers, leopards, whatever, who have been bred and born in the United States to be sold as somebody's pet, which is an unconscionable idea to think of an apex predator, top of the food chain, one of four of the most dangerous animals in the world, and our government says it's okay to do that, and we'll give you a permit through the United States Department of Agriculture. Now, there's a whole lot wrong with that, considering the fact that hundreds and hundreds of adults and children have been maimed for life or killed by these pets.
Well, and what gives people the crazy idea that they should have these big cats as pets? I mean, it's kind of like in that part in Planet of the Apes where people start thinking, you know, apes would make good pets.
Yeah, well, you know, when you get right down to it, how many people, when they want a dog, do they say what kind? Do they look into what kind of dog is it? Is it a hunter? Is it a lap dog? Is it going to need a lot of exercise? How big is it going to grow? How much food is it going to eat? People don't care. They look at that adorable, darling little lion or tiger cub and say, oh, I just got to have one of those. And they have no idea that that's going to grow up into be one of the most dangerous animals in the world. Mm-hmm. And one that they can hardly afford to feed, much less maintain for security purposes. or even give them some semblance of a good life. It's just, there's just nothing good about this.
Is this a case of Americans giving in to their just desire to get what they want and not think about the consequences?
I absolutely believe that. Absolutely believe that. And then when they can't handle them, where do they go? We have two animals here that were the people couldn't control them, so they just let them out. We have one lion who was found walking down the streets of Kirksville, Missouri. I mean, the stories, every single one of them. We have a leopard who was purchased in Texas for $6,000, brought to Newport Beach, and, you know, it was like a little black kitten.
Yeah.
And as he grew, he was scratching the lady's satin sofas and chewing her Jimmy Choo shoes. So she couldn't have that, so she put him in a closet, and he lived in the closet.
Oh, my.
The husband coming home at night, taking the cat out, putting gauntlets up to his shoulders on, and wrestling with the leopard, thereby saying to that cat, this is how you treat humans. You know, this has been such a true nightmare to hear the stories, the sadness of how these animals have been treated.
Oh, but
just breaks my heart.
How did you get involved in this? I mean, how do you go from, you know, getting involved in protecting them? I used to think we needed protection from them, not them from us.
Well, it works both ways. definitely, especially when you get involved with the animals in the circuses. That's the worst. And the circus has become involved with the bill that I'm working on right now. This is my second bill. The first bill that I co-authored in 2003 was titled the Captive Wildlife Safety Act, and that was just a baby step to stop the interstate traffic. And I took it to my own congressman, and he introduced the bill, and I testified for it, and I listed, you have 5 minutes in which to get your point across.
Mm-hmm.
And I listed about 18 accidents, starting with a little 4.5-year-old boy who had his arm ripped off by his uncle's pet tiger in Texas. A little 11-year-old girl went into the tiger's cage with her stepfather to groom a tiger, and he closed the gate. The tiger jumped the little girl, and she was dead. 17-year-old Haley in Kansas went with her friends to have a photograph taken, a unique photograph for their yearbook with a tiger. They all went up, had their picture taken. She went up, the tiger moved, stepped on her foot, she screamed, he jumped her and killed her.
So this is why I've been teaching my teenage daughter as she's learning to drive that the first rule of driving is people is dumb and you move on from there. How did this whole thing first come to your attention? How did you get involved in this, Beck?
Well, I've always been an animal lover. Mm-hmm. That's from birth. But I was doing two films in Africa, back-to-back, one in Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe, and one in South Africa. And that was in 69 and 70. And during those years, environmentalists all over the world were saying, if we, people of the world, didn't do something right then to save the wild animals from encroaching civilization, sport hunting, poaching, etc. By the year 2000, they will be gone. And so there was a lot of awareness going out. And my then husband was a producer. We decided to do a film about the animals in the wild and kicking around ideas. That question was answered very quickly on a photo safari in Mozambique. We saw a house that had been abandoned by a game warden because it flooded during the rainy seasons. He moved out, and a pride of lion moved into that house. It grew to be the largest pride in all of Africa. There must have been 25, 30 lions of all sizes living in that house. It was awesome to see it. They were sitting in the windows, going in and out the doors. They were napping on the verandas. The cubs were playing out in front. It was I have this vision in my head that is just so delightful. I wish I could show it to you.
Sounds like a
anyway,
movie.
Right? Yeah. And so we decided, bingo, here's a perfect movie set. And dealing with animals of which people are fascinated by, scared to death of, or they want to hug them and coochie-coo and tickle their tummies. So we got back to California. The script was written. We wanted to have Hollywood acting animals, a nine-month shoot over and out. But because of what we saw in Africa with all of these cats living together, that's the way the script was written. And every trainer that we handed the script to came back laughing at us, saying, this movie can't be done. And we said, why not? And they said, because of the numbers of animals that you have working together. And we said, well, that's the way we're living in Africa. Hmm. And they said, no, that's not it. It's the numbers of cats you have working together. And there is an instinctual dictate to fight a cat they don't know. I don't want my cat hurt. I don't want to be hurt. Get your own animals to do it. Well, that's the sentence that changed our lives. Get your own animals. The first one was a rescue, and that was in 1972. And from then on, we became a very important facility to California Fish and Game. Different heads of departments in other states were calling us. The Humane Societies, the SPCAs, the private citizen who would call and say, I've made a terrible mistake. I bought a little lion or a tiger. Would you take it? And at one point, we had 150 big cats here.
Wow.
You know, so when our movie was over and all of the funds that we accrued from it were gone, I formed the Roar Foundation in 1983. That's the Roar, our like R-O-A-R, mm-hmm. Foundation, so that we could accept donations because it's the national debt trying to keep this place going.
I bet.
And we call it Shambhala, which means a meeting place of peace and harmony for all beings, animal and human. And I struggle every day of my life trying to raise the $75,000 every month to keep us open.
Wow.
And it's beautiful. We have big areas. They're not in little cages. Some of them are over an acre. And we try to give them some semblance of life for having, you know, the only thing they did wrong was being born in captivity. You know, and there's nothing that we can give any wild animal in captivity that they need. There's not one thing we can give them they need. But it's just wrong to have them here like this.
Why not do what most Hollywood stars do over the years? They write a check, they get a picture taken, and they move on. How did you? I mean, you're living there, for God's sakes.
I am, and it is my goal to get this bill, this new bill passed, which is titled, which I also co-authored, which is titled Big Cats Public Safety Protection Act. And we have my own Congressman, Buck McKeon, introduced the bill. It has a number, H.R. 4122.
Are you concerned? I mean, you said that it costs $75,000 a month to keep the preserve going. Are you concerned? I may have picked up somewhere in my reading that you are somewhere around the retirement age. Are you concerned? did I handle
somewhere
that nicely?
I've long passed it.
Oh, well, I didn't want to say that. That's up to you.
No, I don't care.
What happens in the event that you can't keep raising $75,000
a month? Okay, well, the one thing about being a real sanctuary, you know, there's pseudo-sanctuaries all over the United States. They call themselves sanctuary. Mm-hmm. But to be a real sanctuary, there's no breeding, no buying, no selling, no trading, no commercial use, outside the city limits, adequate veterinary care. Not all veterinarians know how to take care of these animals, nor do they want to. They're dangerous. And you also have to have a financial plan in place, so that if anything happens to the director or the owner, that you don't become part of the problem. Hmm. So it's a no. Whereby now we're really good at what we do. We know exactly what these animals need. We know how dangerous they are. When we were doing our movie, every one of us were hurt. In fact, there were so many accidents by the big cats on us that they were. There was talk of them naming a wing on the Palmdale Hospital after us. It was so bad. You know, and finally, we just say, enough is enough. There will be no contact. And that's been going on for a long number of years.
Was there, when you decided to do this in the 70s and then formalize it in 83, was there someone in Hollywood who was kind of a model for you in the way that you did this, in the sense that, you know, public person doing something, not just writing a check, but actually getting involved? Or
no, this just sort of evolved. It's like, I don't know, the hand of God moving in strange ways. You know, when we first started out and started rescuing these animals and learning about them and what they needed, I hated the fact of little cages. I couldn't bear it. And fortunately, those who stood beside me felt the same way. So, you know, we do things for these animals that I don't think any other place does. They're not in prison in the same place for the rest of their lives. We have corridors in which we can move the animals safely for them and for us to a different area. Hmm. And so they have, you know, the tigers will have a different body of water to play in, a different tree to climb, a different neighbor, different, you know, so that they have some semblance of life. We give them the best of food that we can find. People say, well, why don't you just go to the grocery stores and get the leftover food? I said, I wouldn't eat that kind of food, and I don't expect my cats to eat that. You are what you eat, and there's a uniformity of health here that's just beautiful.
What do you think when you open the paper or hear on TV that someone in Hollywood today is involved with something? And I want to ask you about a serious situation. For example, I mean, as I learned more about what you're doing, I was actually thinking of George Clooney buying a satellite transponder so that he could literally track troop movements in Africa and keep things honest and keep pressure on warlords.
I am saying bravo to him, and if I wasn't so ensconced with this effort, I would be right on his team.
Hmm.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, I mean, he's a great example because we know literally that he's doing these things as opposed to writing a check and, you know.
Right.
But, all right, so I've asked you that. Let me ask you about this. What is it you want to accomplish in Congress with the bill, and are you at all skeptical that at a time when Congress's approval rating is about 9% and they can't do things like fund air traffic control, schools, I don't know.
Well, we can't even support our servicemen when they come home.
Right.
I mean, our government is at its worst.
So
I know that, but what needs to be done here with this issue, with the breeding of the big cats and selling them to whoever has the money to pay for them, is to stop the breeding. Just plain stop it.
Hmm.
And there's an entity, a special interest group, that is trying very hard to stop this bill. It's the circus.
Hmm.
You know, Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey, Kenneth Feld, who I think when God needs money, he calls Kenneth Feld. And this man controls Washington, whatever he wants. He lives in Arlington. He has made noises about the fact he doesn't like this bill. And I am asking, I have written an open letter to Congress. Will anyone stand beside me against Kenneth Feld and his special interest group? This is not only a humane issue. This is a public safety issue. It's a moral issue. And he's got to be stopped.
Mm.
You know, with the first bill that I co-authored in 2003, I was threatened. You know, the exotic animal business is so huge that according to U.S. Fish and Wildlife, it's on a par with illegal drugs. And when that kind of money comes in, because it's dirty money,
mm-hmm.
It gets dangerous. And I received a threat at the preserve. And they may be very tough, but they're not very smart. He left a threat on my answering machine. So I called the authorities, and I said, I don't run scared, but I don't like this. And they came over and listened, and I had to go through a lot. I had to have somebody come and live in my house with me.
Hmm.
I couldn't leave the preserve unless I was with somebody in a rented car. Before we got back into the car to come back to Shambhala, we had to check underneath to see whether a bomb had been planted. I couldn't answer the phones. They had the sheriff come and go through everybody's bags as they came into the preserve. And they found that the man was from out of the state of California. The FBI came in and they got him. Hmm. He was an animal dealer. And everybody asked what happened to him. I don't know. The FBI doesn't let you in on those kinds of information. But with this one, with Kenneth Feld, I have been let to know that I should watch my back. And you know what? I'm telling the truth. Everything that I'm saying is true. Everything. He has been brought up five times that I know of in court because of animal abuse. He pays the $200,000-$300,000 fine and off he goes.
Yeah, he's an interesting character.
No, he isn't. He's an awful, awful man.
I was going to say, several years ago, I spent a full day with him. The circus used to winter, maybe it still does, in Florida, and they would always start the year in either Tampa or St. Petersburg. And I spent a full day with him behind the scenes of the circus and all that kind of stuff. And it was an interesting thing. And then I wrote the story. And he got the story killed. It was for a Canadian magazine. And he got the story killed, and they said the only reason he seemed to want it killed was that it mentioned that he had children. And I thought, that's it? And then over the years, you know, I've read things about him, and I can't understand how a guy who runs the freaking circus can exert so much power over so many things and people and not have to pay the piper. And
he never does.
No, it's
and
it's strange.
He has stopped books from being written about him, about the circus and the brutality that they use against the those poor elephants and the lions and tigers. Honest to God, this man, I don't know what kind of person would allow the beatings that these animals have to endure to do the stupid tricks. I mean, if anybody has been to Africa and seen the beauty of those animals, has anyone ever seen them sit up, stand on their head, do a dance routine, wear tutus? I mean, this is such an insult to these animals. And I think if parents and children knew how they are beaten, they use electric prods on them. They start with the baby elephants, tying their legs together and making them lie down and stay on the ground, and they'll put electric prods in their ears. And they beat them and beat them and beat them for no reason at all. They do this to an animal who has done nothing wrong other than the unfortunate situation of being in the circus. And with the lions and tigers as well. And then they're put they're crammed into vehicles, these great big vans. Oh, there have been seen 8 and 9 elephants come out of one elephant carrying van, living in their own feces, their own urine. There is nothing good about this, and if people knew this, they wouldn't go to the circus. And maybe that's the only way to stop the animals being used in the circus, to don't go. If the circus has animals in it, don't attend. Don't let your kids think that this is an okay thing to do to animals.
Well, I probably should have started the conversation with this, because it's going to be very difficult to transition to talk about something as mundane by comparison as TV and film. But I'm going to use the excuse that it was Hollywood that led you to the cats, and so I'm going to use the cats
lead us back. And I'm very grateful to that. I'm very grateful for that step. Absolutely.
So let me bring us around then. And
okay.
It's going to be the worst segue in history.
But may I just say please to everyone, if you can look up the bill, H.R. 4122, and write to your congressman to support it. Support this bill. Stand up against Kenneth Feld. And don't ever, ever go to a circus with animals in it. It's time. You know, wouldn't it be a wonderful thing if we could be the generation that ends animal abuse?
Of course.
Yeah, I think so.
Well,
okay.
All right. Thank
okay.
you. So, moving back to Hollywood talk, you're going to be shooting scenes, I guess, later this month for the Fox sitcom Raising Hope, in which you will play.
Tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow.
And I have a small part. I play Melanie, my own daughter's mother. And I'm good at that. I've always been a mother.
You didn't have to do any research? There'd be no method acting?
No.
How did this come about? Was this...
So there are roles for people, and, they fill them. And it was my daughter who said, well, why doesn't my mom play my mom? And they said, great. And I'm already deceased, and I'm reading my will on a television. You know, it's coming over on video.
Oh, they do a lot of that on that show.
Funny. Yeah, they do. Yeah, so it's a short role, but it's fun. I just want to do it because of working with my daughter, who I love.
Have you worked with her before? I mean, the Herod experiment,
yeah.
I know, but I mean, more recently?
Well, that was nothing.
Right.
But we did our movie Roar.
Of course.
Together, and that was a long time. Our movie took 5 years.
Hmm. So I'm guessing since you're in this on video, this will not be a recurring role.
Unless they decide to have her come back every now and then on... it's a funny show.
Yeah.
It's a great show.
So I was curious about that, but I have to ask you, because I did a little reading. What I'm really wondering about is we're going to talk about your real family. How does your son-in-law, Antonio Banderas, feel about Melanie being romanced on Raising Hope by Wilmer Valderrama? I mean, come on.
Hey, it's called acting.
Yeah, but geez.
they both do films. You know, they both do films with other
I know.
Actors, and you know.
But that guy's reputation is, well, you know.
Well, he's quite gorgeous. Yeah,
I'm sure he is.
Yeah.
neither one of you has hurt for good-looking co-stars over the years.
That's for sure.
I've
been very lucky.
Sean Connery for some, and.
Yeah, and he was terrific. So was Rod Taylor.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so let's talk about the girl, the HBO movie that dramatizes your relationship with Alfred Hitchcock. How much liberty? I'm assuming you've seen it. How much liberty does the movie take with reality?
Actually, the movie is pretty much right on. I had the wonderful opportunity of Gwyneth Hughes, who wrote the girl, to she came out to Shambhala. We talked at length during the time she was writing. She would call me frequently. We would email each other, and the film is very, very true. The only thing that, you know, in an hour and a half you can only get so much in, and what wasn't shown was the fact that there were times that, you know, it was absolutely fabulous. I mean, wonderful conversations with Hitch about films and about, you know, and he was my drama coach as well as my director, because The Birds was my first film.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, you know, all the dinner parties that we would have with very exciting people in the business. And, you know, there were wonderful times. Otherwise, I want to tell you, I would have been out of there a long time ago. I mean, before I did. But those kinds of times weren't able to be, shown in The Girl. But I have to tell you, when HBO gave a screening of The Girl for me with about 30 people, at the end of the performance, I have never seen an audience like this. Nobody moved. Nobody talked. Until finally my daughter, Melanie, jumped up and said, well, now I have to go back into therapy.
Oh, God, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
I mean, it's a powerful piece. And it's one that should come out. I am not the only one who was affected by Alfred Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm.
Diane Baker was affected. Vera Miles was affected. And, you know, so this was nothing new. I'm just the only one who said, you know what, it's time that this story was told.
Did you ever talk to any of the other women about their treatment by him?
I talked to Diane Baker.
You did?
Yeah. And she talked to me.
Hmm. But you never talked to any of the other women who were affected?
I didn't know them.
Okay, well,
I didn't know them, and I don't know how many were affected. You know, and some of the actresses say, oh, he was just like a big teddy bear, he was like a grandfather. Well, that wasn't the way he was with me.
Hmm. Well, I'm actually looking, I have a... Lorraine Bozzaro's, I'm sorry I butchered his name, but his recent book, Hitchcock Piece by Piece, in front of me. I'm looking at a picture of you and Hitchcock at a table. There's a fake bird in between you. And yeah, I mean, you know, you look at it and you go, oh, Hitchcock, Grandfather Hitchcock. But, do you think that the film will have any impact on his ongoing perception, and should it?
Well, you know, I've put it in two different categories. I will always admire the man for his talent, his genius in making motion pictures. I mean, because he is untouchable
mm-hmm.
in his art, and I don't think anybody can take that away from him. It's the man himself that I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. We hear stories all the time, those of us who are not in Hollywood, not in the movies or television, about how common it is for on-set romances between married and unmarried folks, that it's very common. We just saw, just recently there was this story about Kristen Stewart and her director on a film.
Yeah.
He was married, and she got caught. And I don't want to. There's in no way do I want to suggest excusing Hitchcock's behavior, because as a father of a teenage girl, it's the kind of thing that scares me all the time when I just let her out of the house unaccompanied. But
you should be.
Well, right. I mean, and you know better. You know as well or better than anyone. Is it on a Hollywood set though? Is it less surprising that these things happen, and is that why a lot of these men get away with it, because it's almost expected behavior?
Well, yeah, you've opened a whole can of peas here. First of all, this was not a romance.
Right.
This was control is what he wanted from me. He wanted to control me on every level of my life.
Mm.
And I have never been that kind of person. You're also dealing with, I was at the end of the studio system in which that kind of behavior was the norm.
That's what I was getting at, right.
Yes. And during my fashion modeling days, I was asked twice to go under contract by different studios. Paramount is the one I remember, but in the 50s, when the television sets took over our homes, and everybody was staying home watching The Little Black Box, and people weren't going to films. And when I was offered that contract, I said, if for me to pack up Melanie and the puppy and the kitty and the bunny and move to California for a contract, that in 6 months they could say, things have changed, it's not working out.
Mm.
I had a great career in commercials and fashion modeling in New York, and I said, this isn't a good business move. But it was different when, in 1961, when I had moved back to California, because I wanted Melanie. Melanie was 4 years old then, and I wanted her to have some semblance of independence, like, Mommy, I'm going out to play,
mm-hmm.
which you can't do if you live in this city of New York. And so I had purchased a, not purchased, rented an expensive home in Westwood, and things weren't going exactly as I had hoped. And then on Friday, the 13th of October, I received this call from Universal asking if I was the girl in the Seago commercial. And he said, there's a producer that was interested. I said, who is it? And he said, well, come over and we'll talk about it. So I went over to Universal, and for four days, nobody told me who this person was until they had me go to MCA to meet with an agent. And it was he, Herman Citrin, who was Hitch's agent, said, Alfred Hitchcock wants to sign you to a contract. Here it is. I want you to read it. If you agree with the terms and sign it, we will go over to meet him. So I was under contract to Alfred Hitchcock before I even met him. That's unheard of. That is unheard of.
I can see that that would be unheard of. On the other hand, what we have heard plenty of is men in the Hollywood system, both then and now, seeing a pretty girl and deciding she's going to be in my show and I'm going to whatever with her. I mean, it was this power that they feel entitled to.
I think that exists, and that has existed for a millennium since there has been man and female, or male and female. I think that doesn't just eliminate any other business. I think this sort of thing happens in every business.
Can you?
Don't you believe that?
Oh, I do. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's just that, you know, because
I think it's. I think it's just a much more glamorous type of thing to talk about in the movies.
Right. Exactly. I was going to say, because of movies and TV, it's certainly, you know, we see more of it, we hear more about it. You don't hear much about it, you know, in offices and in, the sanitation company, that kind of thing. But, you know, lust is lust, and
lust is lust.
What are you going to do? Can you explain to a young woman today who at least has some options now for reporting, you know, sexual harassment, what it was like to be young, female, and, you know, vulnerable in the early 60s when that did not exist, that those protections?
Well, yeah, I was young and vulnerable, but I was not, living in New York, being a fashion model, and the commercials and all of that, you know. This was not the first time that I had to deal with people like this. This is the first time that I had the kind of control that this man wanted. And that's what I was dealing with. And it was absolutely awful. And people were saying, well, was he in love with you? No, that is not love. When you love someone, you care about them. You want to be nurturing and understanding. And there was nothing like that. It was just absolute, if I can't control you, you will do nothing else. Because when I demanded to get out of the contract, he said, well, you can't. You have your daughter to take care of. Your parents are getting older. And I said, nobody who loves me would want me in a situation in which I'm not happy. I want to get out. At the end of Marnie, I want to be out. And he said, I'll ruin your career. And he did. He kept me under contract, paying me my $600 a week. For about a year and a half, and he gave the contract to Universal. And at one point, they said they came to me with a television show that I didn't think I was right for. And I said, I don't want to do this. And they said, well, if you don't, you're out of the contract. Well, I extended my hand and said, perfect, I'm out. And then I was out. And 2 weeks later, Charlie Chaplin called to have me do. Marlon Brando's wife in The Countess of Hong Kong. But this situation with Hitchcock was bizarre. It was confining. It was, I felt like every day, what am I going to walk into today? What kind of fight am I going to have to put up today? It was a nightmare.
You know, I completely forgot about Chaplin, and now that you've mentioned it, I want to ask you, what was it like after, you know, your experiences with Hitchcock, working with Chaplin, who, you know, has, I mean, and I can tell you, I took a course in him. I've read 18 to 20 books on him. I was always fascinated with him. And not just because of, you know, what he accomplished, but the man himself was a screwed up, complicated guy. But since you mentioned it, I'm kind of curious.
So was Hitchcock.
Right, yeah.
I mean, maybe that's part of genius. You know, and when Donald Spoto, the girl is taken from The Dark Side of Genius, which is written by that wonderful biographer, Donald Spoto. Mm-hmm. And he devoted chapter 13 to the Hitchcock Hedron years. And that's what the girl is based on. But, yeah, maybe there is this dark side of genius that is... it's too bad it can't be something that's enlightening and wonderful and impressive. Well, this was impressive, but not in the way that you would want it to be.
And anything, now, by the time you worked with Chaplin, that was his last film, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Right? Okay. He must have been a very different person to work under than he was during Gaslight or, you know.
Well, that I can't answer. I don't know what he was like then, but all I can tell you is that the way he directed was so incredibly delightful that I kept saying there should be a second unit watching him, because the way he directed, which I have to say Marlon Brando was so upset with it that he wanted to quit.
What was he doing?
Charlie would come onto the set and he would act out all of our roles. He'd become my character, and then he'd become Sophia's character, and then Marlon's character, and then he'd say, okay, now you do it. Well, but he was so perfect. He honestly would almost change his body postures. His whole body would change when he was playing Sophia and me. I mean, it was just amazing to watch this.
And why
I just loved it. I loved it.
Why was Brando so unhappy with that? It sounds like...
Method acting.
Okay.
Oh, boy, no. Marlon did not appreciate that. Mm-mm.
But if he had chosen to take a role with Chaplin at that point in Chaplin's career, I would think it would be to have that opportunity to work with someone like that and see how he did it. I would think... I don't know. I mean, I don't have any insight into Marlon Brando, but...
I loved it, and I think Sophia had fun doing it, and, you know, everybody's different, but boy, those method actors are, it's a whole different way of, thespians, you know?
I guess. All right, I've got to ask you one more thing, and you've been quite charming, and I appreciated your time today. But this last question, it may seem a little difficult, and I don't mean it to be that way, but, you know, I was reading your official bio on the Shambhala Preserve website, mm-hmm. which I'll mention is shambhala.org.
Thank you.
Sure. And it starts with a lot of Alfred Hitchcock, strangely, considering what we've been talking about. There's a lot of praise from Hitchcock for you and your acting.
Yes, there was. Yes, there was.
I just thought it just seemed a little, I don't know, counter, I don't know.
No, and that's the way it was when it began. I mean, he had all kinds of wonderful things to say about me and my talent. And, you know, it was he and Alma who were my drama coaches on this. And we had a great time doing it. And I loved what he taught me. He gave me such a good basis for acting mm-hmm. that I've used it ever since.
It wasn't
the acting part of it. It was as the time went on. By the end of the Birds, this whole control was beginning, and. And then, of course, there was a time off before we started Marnie, and then as Marnie progressed, the control became, you know, what he would try to control mm-hmm. became worse. He never won. I never ever acquiesced to any of his control.
Mm-hmm. But why consider...
And you know what? I think this film is going to be very important for young women to see. Mm. That they do not have to do anything that a boss, someone who is over them in their jobs, that they don't want to do, and have the strength to say no and get out if they have to.
No.
Well, and keep their head up high.
Well, I'm all in favor of that. Like I said, as a dad of a teenage girl, I'd like her to see more things like that.
Absolutely.
Less of the opposite. Well, folks, listen, you can see Tippi Hedren's tempestuous relationship, can we call it that, with Alfred Hitchcock, portrayed in the HBO film The Girl, which will start showing in October. And look for her in something a little more fun in an episode of the Fox sitcom Raising Hope. Opposite
I wish
her.
It was longer in Raising Hope, because it's a funny role, and I wish it could be longer, but it isn't.
Well, you know, people on that show, there's a fellow on that show, an actor named Greg Binkley, who started off as did a cameo, and they liked him, and they kept bringing him back, and he never thought it would become a regular, and then last year he became a regular. So, hey, maybe we'll see more of you.
Yeah, but I'm starting out dead.
Yeah, but, you know. isn't the mom on that show of Hope, she's in prison or dead or something, right?
Yeah.
So,
well, there may be a way.
She keeps coming back.
Yeah, she does.
Yeah.
You never know.
All right. Well, let me give out the URL again for the Shambhala Preserve, which is the Roar, R-O-A-R Foundation. It is shambhala.org, shambhala.org. Is the preserve, do you have a Facebook page, a Twitter, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, we have all those things.
Okay.
Yeah, we do. Yes, we do.
All right.
And please, if you ever get to, I don't know where you are in this world, but if you ever get to Southern California, please come and meet the very beautiful, dangerous wild ones of Shambhala. Mm-hmm. We have, we're open, we're rather exclusive. We're only open one weekend a month with a reservation and a small donation. And we have wonderful programs. We have Adopt a Wild One program where you become a wild parent and you can come and visit your wild one the first Saturday of every month, and we throw the great big huge femur bones of meat over to them, and then you see a different side of that cat. Pretty scary side, because food is one of the most important things, and they will kill you over it.
Not if I don't give them the chance. and on that note, Tippi Hedren, thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
Well, you've been delightful to talk to, and thank you for being so informed.
Thank you. You can see and hear almost 1,000 Mr. Media interviews by visiting our main site, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Or check out the more than 200 video interviews on the Mr. Media radio site on YouTube. And I'd sure appreciate if you'd show some love for Mr. Media's advertisers, including Stitcher. Apple named Stitcher a top 5 news app of 2011. It's a free mobile app for your smartphone or tablet that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. You can listen whenever you want to more than 5,000 shows, get customized recommendations, and discover what your friends are listening to. My own list of Stitcher favorites is pretty eclectic. I start my day with an hour of MSNBC's Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. Then it's the latest 2-minute update from the Onion News Network. After that, I'll listen to WTF with Mark Maron, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin, HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, and excerpts from E's Chelsea Lately and The Soup with Joel McHale. Also in regular rotation on my Stitcher playlist, The BS Report with ESPN's Bill Simmons, The TechCrunch Headlines, and The Don Geronimo Show. The latest episodes of each show, whether originating from broadcasts, cable TV, radio syndication, or podcasts, are continuously updated. Stitcher is a free app for your iPhone, iPad, Kindle, Fire, BlackBerry, Droid, and more. And show your support of Mr. Media by getting, did I mention it's free? The app at stitcher.com/Mr. Media. That's stitcher.com/MR Media. Stitcher Smart Radio. the smarter way to listen to radio. We're also supported by Audible. Check out Audible's 30-day trial membership and download the audiobook version of the book everyone's been talking about, 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Sign up for your free trial today at audible.com/radio. Again, audibletrial.com/radio. And finally, if you need a disc jockey for a wedding, bar mitzvah, corporate event, or just a big old party, please consider calling 1-800-DIAL-DJS, the party authority for all your party entertainment needs. You can call 1-800-DIAL-DJS or go to their website, 1-800-DIAL-DJS.com, and tell them Mr. Media sent you. And thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Mark Margolis. I played Tio on Breaking Bad. And if you don't start listening to Mr. Media, I'm going to have to ding my bell.